This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will talk with Jeremy Alford of Law Politics. We'll remember John McGinnis, of course, the man who founded this entity in our community and across the country, one which people who are immersed in our state's political culture get their fix almost every day of every week. And we're 12 weeks away from an election with Mary Landrieu seeking a fourth term, 84 days from today. We'll talk about that race, and we're only 14 months away from a statewide cycle with governor, lieutenant governor, and all the other statewide races up for grabs. All this with Jeremy Alford. Also, Stephen Maitland Lewis, noted author, now living in New Orleans. His latest book is Botticelli's Bastard. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And online, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. You may also tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and thanks to Erica Crenshaw, who sat in yesterday and did fine work. Our guest is Jeremy Alford, the editor and publisher of LawPolitics.com and Law Politics Weekly. He's here to talk about what's going on in our world, particularly in the world of politics. But it has only been a few months, actually less than three, that we lost John McGinnis, the greatest political writer of all time in Louisiana. He died on May 25th, and Jeremy, I'm sure it still stings to this day.
It does. I was thinking about him this morning, and especially on Thursday mornings when I'm putting the weekly together, but it's not difficult to think about John and to kind of hear his voice in the back of my head of what he would say or what he would think about a particular issue.
He liked covering politics, didn't he?
He did. It was John's life, and I don't think anyone was better at it, especially when it came to Louisiana politics. And I think I learned more in my 3 years working for John than I did my entire freelance career.
And that's been a while. You've done this since 96 or thereabouts?
Thereabouts. I've been an independent journalist coming up on 13 years. I covered the Edwards trial for WJBO and worked at WAFB right after that and met my wife there. I was cutting a story in the editing bay, and a voice came over yelling at me, asking where my story was. And
yeah.
I was determined to go, you know, let this individual know that I was not going to be yelled at. And we walked away, ended up asking her to an LSU game, and that was history.
Well, it turned out well. Yeah. Sometimes that's the way it goes. Friction can occasionally be a spark to more compelling relationships. Now, John McGinnis was a guy who loved covering Louisiana politics, and as you say, he used to say he owed it all to the material, but he was one of a kind.
Yeah, when he would say that, I think we all know better. You know, John put in the time, and he worked his sources, and you know, candidates would call him for advice, and John was a one of a kind. He had sources in every nook and cranny of state government and had a way of turning a phrase that would otherwise might turn off a source or a politician, and everyone would walk away friends at the end of the day.
And I saw Dean Jerry Seppus at Louis today, and the man who heads the Manship School has proudly unveiled the McGinnis Scholarship at LSU. This is something that is appropriate.
It is, and John didn't want a memorial. He didn't want any attention, but I think this is something that John would have embraced. It's a need-based scholarship that will be based also on a 725-word column on the best and possibly worst of Louisiana politics. That was our length for our opinion columns, and there will be a panel that reviews those. But the recipient will also serve a brief internship when the legislature is in session. I've had a few people joke with me. They ask me if I'm trying to turn people away from journalism by having them intern at the Capitol. But I think it's going to be a great experience. We'll get the students credentialed, and they'll cover a couple of committees for a few weeks. But you know, we have a real shot of endowing this scholarship fund, and we're hoping that John's friends and the folks who feel like John impacted their life will step up and make a donation.
And John always noted the impact that his experience at LSU had on his career. He is a member of the Manship School Mass Communication Hall of Fame, but he left us much too soon at the age of 66 on May 25th of this year. And John was not one of those who discussed a lot about himself. The other people were the story. But he gamely fought some tough odds over the last few years. He had some health issues that he didn't proclaim to the world, but he kept on going, didn't he?
That's right. John's Irish roots wouldn't allow him to complain out loud and let anybody feel sorry for him. But, you know, John had a heart attack a few years ago that he was dealing with, and he also had a blood disorder that the doctors that he went to just didn't quite know what to do with. He sought treatment for it. And right before the session started, he decided, and along with his physician, that it just wasn't the treatments just weren't working. But John carried on. I think over the last couple of weeks before he passed, we could all tell that something was going on. But John never changed. He had a huge love for not only politics but life. And I can remember convincing him to stay home one day, and he was going to go see his doctor. And I didn't hear from him about 5:30, so I called him and. Asked him where he was, and he told me, I'm eating frog legs at the Pentagon Barracks with some lobbyists. So even for one day, he couldn't stay away.
And Richard Cole, the man who is large and in charge at DiGiulio's, told me that John's last night on Earth was in the French Quarter at some of his favorite places. So he went out the way he would have wanted to.
I think so.
297-5633 for Jeremy Alford. Today is the 62nd birthday of Mayor President Melvin Kip Holden, who is running for Lieutenant Governor, and that field got a little more crowded today.
That's right. It became official at 8 a.m. Jefferson Parish President John Young has announced for the seat. I think it's probably the worst kept secret in Jefferson Parish that he was going to announce for Lieutenant Governor. And, I think we're going to see John Young try to run to the right of the field. He's already had a very targeted direct email campaign that he's been running for a couple months with taking on issues like Obamacare, you know, issues that really have nothing to do at all with Lieutenant Governor. He'll also be able to run as a reformer of sorts. I think most folks in South Louisiana know that he followed the administration of Aaron Broussard. A lot of those folks ended up on trial. So he can kind of present the image of being a reformer in Jefferson.
What does that do to Billy Nungesser's prospects? He ran last time, and he's president of a neighboring parish, and he got 47% of the votes. It was a relatively close race against Jay Darden, and he's claiming he's back for another run, and you would think that those two might be fishing in the same pond for their voters.
Yeah, I think they are. I think Billy Nungesser is going to try to run to the right as well. He's announced officially. One distinction that we can draw right now is oil and gas issues. You know, both of those parishes saw their parish councils file suits against oil and gas companies for violations of the Coastal Code, the Coastal Act. Obviously, business industry, the oil and gas lobby, were opposed to these moves. They're expected to get involved in parish council races, which is really interesting. We've never seen them get involved on the local level. But whereas Billy Nungesser has walked a fine line on how he feels about these lawsuits, John Young has been a little bit more receptive. He's got involved in drives at the Capitol to preserve these lawsuits. We could see business and industry maybe gravitate toward Billy Nungesser, but you know it's still early. The field isn't settled. I think the only other announced candidate is Kip Holden.
Kip Holden and Elbert Guillory has indicated he may run, a black Republican, which would be interesting. And if you slice the field so many ways, it's improbable, but not inconceivable that we might have a runoff between two African Americans. Wouldn't that be something?
That would be interesting. And I spoke to Senator Guillory just a few days ago. He said he is leaning against running in the 5th Congressional District. He's more interested in Lieutenant Governor. I also have spoken with Scott Angell, Public Service Commissioner, who actually served as Lieutenant Governor in an interim position. He is expected to make an announcement next month. He may run for governor. He may run for Lieutenant Governor. But, you know, if you look at the field, both for governor and lieutenant governor, there is a void in Acadiana. There's no candidate from Southwest Louisiana. And if he could, if he can unite that region, he can be a strong force in that race.
Yeah, I think he would be the favorite if he got in the race for lieutenant governor. Right. But governor, that's a different story. There are a lot of Republicans, including David Vitter, Jay Darden, maybe John Kennedy. You think he'll run for governor?
I don't know. You know, it seems like he would have made some stronger moves by now. But I think the treasurer is getting at a point where, you know, he's going to have to decide that if he wants to chase the brass ring one last time or, mm-hmm. or finish up as treasurer.
Mm-hmm. He's 60, about to be 63 years old, born the same year as now the late Robin Williams. But John Kennedy has run for several offices, and he has only been elected to one, but he's been elected treasurer now, let's see, 99, 03, 07, 11, four times. So he's probably able to cruise in on to reelection there, but he's always had his eye on something, quote, bigger. Now, there are some who believe that Kennedy might quietly tell Senator Vitter that he would be interested in succeeding him if Senator Vitter becomes governor, and that would seem to be a possibility. If if Vitter won, he gets to appoint a successor.
He does, and it's hard to imagine that he wouldn't try to leverage that opportunity. But you know, we interviewed Senator Vitter about that possibility for La Politics Weekly, and he told us that no deal will be cut, and there'll be a group of folks who mm-hmm. sit down and decide who will fill that seat. But those rumors are going to swirl. You know, we've mm-hmm. we've heard that Congressman John Fleming might be the choice for that seat, he will have to fill that role if he gets elected.
And the Vitter scandal, is it over with, or is that going to percolate again?
As John McGinnis liked to say, it takes more than one sex scandal to sink a Louisiana politician. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that we'll see some very interesting ads probably right before the primary in 2015. But, you know, David Vitter has won a statewide election since the controversy. Mm-hmm. He faced Charlie Melancon on the ballot, and then voters seemed to mm-hmm. forgive him in the way of votes. Whether it happens again, it remains to be seen. But he has a strong lead in the polls, and I think financially he's got the jump on everybody. There's a super PAC, which of course cannot coordinate with the candidate, but the super PAC is actively taking donations above Louisiana's cap for donations. There was a recent lawsuit that cleared the way for them, and they're not waiting around for the Ethics Administration to appeal.
He will be well healed, and he has favorites, it appears, who are running in other races. He says there's no ticket, and whether you call it a ticket or not, he, like many other politicians, and I can't say I blame him, if you got the capacity to do it, why not bring your friends along with you for the ride?
Most notably, former Congressman Jeff Landry is running for Attorney General, and I think that's one race that's really going to heat up going into next year. Buddy Caldwell has gotten crossways with many, many folks, from the governor to oil and gas to, mm-hmm. to business and industry. And, you know, David Vitter has made some very strong moves to create some allies with business and industry in Louisiana. And those are the folks who are upset with Buddy Caldwell right now. And then Vitter is backing Landry. And, you know, the super PAC has also spent some money on insurance commissioner Jim Donilon. So, you know, that ticket may go further down the ballot than we'd ever imagine.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org. For Jeremy Alford, the editor and publisher of Law Politics. Nick asks about George Kennedy, the political consultant for Jay Darden. Will he use the indiscretions of the senator in the race next year?
You know, if anybody could pull it off with a little bit of wit and color, it would certainly be Mr. George Kennedy, who is also the brother of Treasurer John Kennedy. You know, Darden has brought in a national team to run his campaign. George is still going to do media. And George, as I understand, was involved in hiring the campaign manager and then the new polling firm.
George used to come on the statewide show I had as a Democratic activist. He doesn't brandish his Democratic past too much anymore. I even wonder if he switched parties. That might be something to check. George Calhoun Kennedy, 9155. Is he a Republican now? Sometimes that becomes a priority when you work for a big-time candidate. But we'll talk more with Jeremy Alford. And go to the phones in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Frank Barnett is producing, and the out-of-the-area number is 877-217-5757 for Jeremy Alford, editor and publisher of LawPolitics.com. And as noted, we're 84 days away from the U.S. Senate election with Mary Landrieu and Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus, and we'll talk about that and more, and we'll hear from you. HB in Denham Springs. Good morning, HB. You're on WRKF.
Good morning, gentlemen. Sir, I'd like to ask you a question that's in connection with the people's public opinion of the progress of our Congress is at the lowest level almost in history. How would you rate the progress of our Louisiana legislature and the guidance of the governor insofar as tackling the really tough issues that the public is most concerned about? Thank you, sir.
I think this session in particular was pretty messy, especially in hindsight. There's no solution offered on Common Core. We've seen at least two bills, one involving the retirement benefits of the state police superintendent and another involving retirement ages for constables and justices of the peace that seem to slip through without the proper parties having a voice in it. Governor Jindal in particular, I think, has one foot out the door. This was the lightest administration agenda that we've seen in probably two terms. So with the legislature going into its final year before reelection, I wouldn't have high hopes for any fireworks in 2015, although I think the lawmakers ought to avoid setting cruise control right now. You know, they have a real opportunity next year is a year where they can take up tax issues. I think most of them are probably going to want to do the least controversial issues that they can get filed. But I think they ought to give voters credit, and I think voters may respect them more for taking on some heavy issues in their final year.
297-5633 for Jeremy Alford, the editor and publisher of Law Politics. Got two Jeremys out there running big-time media organizations. Jeremy White of Red Stick, he kind of takes a different angle than you on occasion, but quite often you're covering the same events. And there is some humor in Louisiana politics, and John McGinnis, I think he found that humor amid the obvious serious nature that the politics takes. He spent a lot of time in courtrooms and in bar rooms.
Yeah, we did that together as well. That's one thing I heard about John is his sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And I think one of our first conversations, I brought it up as well. But John always found a humorous way to tackle a subject. And I think sometimes that helps to digest the more controversial and complex topics of Louisiana politics.
Mm-hmm. And you bonded at the Edwards trial, which now, as hard as it is to believe, is 14 and a half years ago. But May 9th, 2000, I don't think many people thought that 14 years later he would be running for Congress, but he's back, and he's going to get some votes, apparently. I would bet that he'll finish first in the primary. After that, it gets murky, but I think there's little doubt that he'll get more votes than anybody else come 12 weeks from today in the 6th District.
I'd have to agree with that, and I saw the governor Saturday night in New Orleans. And he was his usual jovial self. He grabbed me by the tie and then gave me a quick Cajun joke that I can't repeat on the air. it was classic Edwards. And he gave a speech at the Jefferson Jackson Dinner. It's an annual fundraiser for the Louisiana Democratic Party, and he worked him up into a frenzy. And I think he's definitely going to mm-hmm. lead the primary. The question is which lucky Republican is going to make the runoff with him.
Well, that he can do. I was looking the other day, just out of curiosity, at the list of delegates in 1992 to the Democratic National Convention when Bill Clinton got the nomination the first time. And Mary Landrieu was a delegate, but so was Edwin Edwards. So was Kip Holden. A lot of Democrats, and some of whom have gone to jail. Jim Brown was a delegate, and Larry Bankston was a delegate in 1992. And the Democratic Party has produced some real talent over the last half century, but some of the most prominent ones, and I mentioned Larry because I think he would have been governor had he not had his issues with the law. The bench now is not very deep for Democrats, and that may be why Edwin Edwards is suddenly a star again at the age of 87. What happened to the Democratic Party in our state?
I think the state shifted to the right, and we saw a wave of Democrats switch parties in the legislature, which is usually kind of the pool from which the Democratic Party would pull politicians and turn them into superstars. But right now the bench is light. I think in North Louisiana, probably the strongest Democrat is Public Service Commissioner Foster Campbell. And despite all of the money he has in the bank and his strong polls, we're starting to see conservative groups start to target him. I think he'll make it past this primary, though. And of course, you have Mitch Landrieu, and the big question being, is he going to run for governor? You have to sit back, and you have to. I think quality of life for a politician plays into his decision. You know, he lost a handful of council races. The city is dealing with some very, very serious financial issues, the infrastructure problems, crime. He's got to be looking at all this and wondering what life is like in the mansion in Baton Rouge.
297-5633 for Jeremy Alford, and getting to the George Kennedy mystery of a few moments ago, whether or not he's still a Democrat. I have, and I give out business cards, and my business card has my cell phone number on it, and I've got a text here from a cell phone number I do not recognize, and this person, whoever it is, says Mr. Kennedy has taken advantage of the new law and is now registered as an independent. So George Kennedy, according to whoever sent me this text message, is an independent. We'll have to check into that.
We have to. George is definitely independently minded.
He is an independent thinker and keeps different hours than most people in his line of work. You know, I've commented on this show. He got Bill Cassidy elected to Congress because he's the one who masterminded the Michael Jackson entry into the race when Don Cashew was the incumbent, and that was the one time we had closed primaries. So Jackson runs as an independent. He gets 12%. Cashew got 40 and Cassidy got 48. And it's a pretty good bet that most of the 12% that went to Jackson would have gone to Cashew, and he would have defeated Bill Cassidy. So Bill Cassidy is elected, and George's thanks is that he's sent on the way, and then he sued him to get his money. What happened to that lawsuit? Do you know?
I don't remember, but I would say that George landed on his feet, and he's always seemed to have a strong horse with Jay Darden. I think George has been involved in practically every election that Jay Darden has ever run, dating back to LSU student government.
Yeah, they have been together since the 70s, and I'm sure if Jay Darden wins, they'll be together for 4 or 8 more years. And I think this is the last dance for Jay Darden, who's 60 years old. He doesn't have aspirations to be president, and I think he would serve his 2 terms as governor if he had to and then go his way. But that is becoming less and less a reality in Louisiana. I think even David Vitter, at the age of 53, has aspirations that go beyond the governor's office, even though he says this is it for him. He's young enough that if he does a good job, if he were elected a couple of times, he could run for president at 62. So why do these Louisiana politicians no longer feel like the governor's office is nirvana? They're keeping that one eye out on at least one on the White House.
I think for the most part, I think most Louisiana boys and girls that get into politics here eventually want to become governor. I think that a trend has started, though, that began with Governor Bobby Jindal. I think folks became more exposed to national politics and saw the possibilities there. I still think that governor is the brass ring for the rank and file elected officials.
Mark in Denham Springs. Mark, you're on the air with Jeremy Alford. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I'm calling because I'm just interested in trying to find out how does a convicted felon speaking of course, former Governor Edwards be allowed to run in a congressional race.
All right. Well, you may want to address that.
The governor cannot run for governor. That he is prohibited
Edwards
from running,
cannot run right. for a statewide race.
But he can run for Congress. And I actually asked him when he announced if he was still eligible to vote, and he kind of laughed and looked at me and he said, no, but they won't let me carry a gun. That's one prohibition that was still
He is eligible to vote now, though.
Yeah, he is.
But
of course,
when he first got out of jail, he was not. And I remember seeing him at an IHOP where he was mobbed, by the way. And people, this was 2012, people were asking him who he was going to vote for president. And he says, well, I can't vote. So at that time, he did not have that option. But he does now. So he not only will presumably be voting for himself, but if he wins, he'll be voting for the rest of us in the 6th District in a few months. But it would seem, Jeremy, the odds are against him winning because the demographics of that district just aren't well suited for any Democrat, whether it's Edwin Edwards or Bill Clinton or whoever would be running in that district.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because I believe Edwin Edwards created the jungle primary system, and now he actually gets to run in it. But you know, a race and a competitive race has never been waged in this district before. It was just redistricting during the last census, and so there are some unknowns. But I think you're right. I think it's going to be really tough for him to pull it off in any kind of runoff.
Dorothy and Goodwood. Dorothy, you're on the air with Jeremy Alford. Hi, Dorothy.
Good morning. Regarding the Mary Landrieu Senate race, a lot of national pundits are saying that she's going to have a very rough time. And the polls say, though, that she's ahead of everybody by a substantial margin. How do you see that race turning out?
Well, I would... You know, Mary Landrieu has led some polls, but
not by substantial margins.
Right. And we actually did an analysis and a chart you can find at lapolitics.com, lapolitics.com, that we looked at all the runoff scenarios dating back to February of last year. And that race has flipped one way or the other, including ties, I think 7 or 8 times. So it is going to be a very close race, and Landrieu admits it herself. I think it's kind of interesting right now watching what's going on with the debates, because it seems like Landrieu is, Cassidy is running it almost like an incumbent. He hasn't agreed to any debates. He's limiting his exposure to the press, whereas Landrieu has accepted, I think, 4 debates so far and has had an open door to the press.
It is amazing that Bill Cassidy is doing this, and I'm sure it's because his advisors are telling him to, because I don't think this is in his nature. In fact, a few years ago, he showed up for a debate with some candidates who were not real threats to him when he was running for re-election to Congress. He didn't have to do it, but he did at the press club, and I commended him. But he made a statement there that he was against funding for public broadcasting, taxpayer funding, and... it got front page news, and I think it's because of those kinds of things where a statement or two can take a life of their own that he is cooling his heels right now, and he's waiting presumably for a December runoff. And my guess is that there will be a December runoff with Cassidy and Landrieu. What would have to happen for that not to occur?
A Christmas morning miracle, I would think. But, you know, Cassidy and Landrieu have participated in a forum recently. So they have, you know, faced off face-to-face. And I think it's interesting that Cassidy keeps bringing up that Louisiana could very well decide the partisan makeup of the Senate. If this race goes into a runoff and we have a December election, we'll be the last one in Louisiana. I know you spoke to Ken Rudin about this, mm-hmm. the political junkie. And, you know, the more I look at it and I look at the National Republican Senate Committee, they've expanded their map by twice. They've doubled the size of the number of races they're targeting at 12. The New York Times recently, their model has given Republicans a 60% chance of taking it. That's all to say I'm not completely convinced that this race is going to decide the makeup of the the U.S. Senate, in which case, you know, the attention span could drop off a bit after the primary.
But let's say Republicans will control the Senate. That is a given. I'm saying hypothetically, or it could be the other way. But right now, there's a 60% chance, according to the New York Times, that Republicans will regain control of the Senate. If that happens, and this seat means a two-vote majority or a one-vote majority or three votes, it's still a significant seat.
Absolutely, and it'll still be, to an extent, a media circus down here. I think, in some respects, it already is. There's a great deal of attention down here, especially lately, with whether or not Mary Landrieu's chairmanship of the Senate Energy Committee matters. And I only bring that up because I've been wondering lately, you know, if the Republicans do take the Senate, David Vitter, the ranking member of the Public Works Committee, you know, if he really focused his efforts in Washington, I wonder if he would have a real shot at becoming a chairman or maybe, you know, at least taking over one of the subcommittees that have some rank, because that's a very important committee to Louisiana.
That's right. He's giving up something tangible. And what I recall, when he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives, he resigned his state house seat. He put all his marbles in the race for the congressional seat that had been vacated by Bob Livingston. Don't think he'll be resigning his Senate seat this time.
No, I don't think so. When he said that this would be his last race for governor, that win or lose, that would be the last office, if you know. I asked him to clarify because I wanted to make sure that he also referring to the Senate. And I got no response from the campaign in regard to that. So I would imagine that he would continue to serve into the Senate as long as he can.
And if he loses the governor's race, that probably would make his Senate race the following year even more compelling.
Right. He would definitely have to carry that over.
Gaston in South Downs. Good morning. You're on with Jeremy Alford. Hi, Gaston.
Good morning. I was curious if law politics is ever, I kind of think it might be a good topic to revisit the gambling revenues that we take in, since initially they were dedicated to education when Edwards kind of helped facilitate some of these legislations, and then they were politically manipulated to go to the general fund. And I thought, seeing that last month they said our casinos took in $200 million, we ought to go ahead and revisit that issue.
All right. I'm not sure those monies ever were dedicated to higher education or secondary education or any kind of education. That was more of a hope than
law. I think lawmakers and some officials sold it that way to the public. And there was legislation this year that we covered, and we did a great infographic. You can find it at lawpolitics.com on just how that money does break down. And it was legislation by Representative Joe Harrison, and the lion's share of the money isn't going to education currently. There are a lot of folks who kind of get a piece of the pie. The bill didn't really go that far, but we have done some reporting on it, and if you go and search on the website, you should be able to find the infographic.
As mentioned, 12 weeks away from an election, and right now it's somewhat quiet, considering that this is one that is supposedly a toss-up. There's a lot of television advertising, some radio. What's going to happen in the next 84 days with Landrieu and Cassidy heading down the stretch?
Well, I think the race is going to stay tight, and I think it's going to end up being decided by the ground games that the respective campaigns have sunk a great deal of money into.
The ground game. That means Leonard Fournette. And
that means getting out on election day and knocking on doors and making phone calls.
And getting people to the polls. As Mary Landrieu did with great vigor and success in 1996 when she beat Lewis Elwood Woody Jenkins by 5,788 votes. Will it be that close again? We'll talk about it. Some more time with Jeremy Alford when we return. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Jeremy Alford of Law Politics, and then we'll hear from the well-versed and interesting, when I say interesting, that's an understatement, novelist, Stephen Maitland Lewis. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. And also, I'm just the politics is a good, you know, I really appreciate what you're doing, and you're doing a good job with it.
My
question for you is, I know Americans for Prosperity is a Karl Rove organization. I believe that's true. Could you do you know the names of those super PACs that are in Louisiana that are going to throw a whole lot of money at these races?
Boy, Karl Rove's super PAC is, I believe, Crossroads GPS. Americans for Prosperity finds its roots with the Koch brothers. There are really a handful of super PACs on both sides of the Senate race. They've been spending money on TV since before Christmas. I wish I could tick them off for you, but there are so many. Americans for Prosperity, they have been spending money on the Senate race. They are not going to get involved in the congressional races. However, as we were talking, discussing before the break, they are going to be heavily involved in the ground game for conservative voters and Republicans. They have field offices around the state. I want to say Shreveport, Lafayette, Baton Rouge, maybe even New Orleans. But the super PAC trend is interesting because it's really just a bunch of billionaires fighting a bunch of billionaires, and there's no other venue for them to do it.
Well, and there are some super PACs backing Senator Landrieu as well, so it's not like it's a one-sided affair here. And I would think that there'll be a lot of money spent, but if Senator Landrieu loses, it won't be because she has been outspent. She's going to have the resources to mount an effective campaign.
I agree.
And I think if Rob Manus had more money, he would be dangerous, especially to Mr. Cassidy. But he just, at this point, doesn't have the resources. With 12 weeks to go, it's hard to raise, you know, $4 or $5 million in walking around money.
Yeah, make no mistake, the Cassidy campaign is paying attention to Rob Manus. I interviewed a source with the campaign a few weeks ago for a feature story, and they described Manus as a political fly that they couldn't just swat away from their face, and they said that they wish that they could focus totally on Landrieu instead of having to look over their shoulders every now and then to wonder what Manus is doing.
Well, and if it comes down to a street fight between a military war veteran and a liver doctor, my money might be with Colonel Manus. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on the air with Jeremy Alford.
Oh, this is Randy and Zachary,
okay.
But my question for you is, do the Louisiana voters really pay attention to what the votes that are made by the Republicans in Congress? And so my second question to you is, do you think that after all the anti-Obama fervor that has been going on in the state, that we will ever have a minority representative being elected to a statewide office?
I don't know if I understand the first part of the question, but I would say that right now we have a minority in the governor's office. I would say to an extent we have a minority in the U.S. Senate. Senior Senator Mary Landrieu is a woman. I wouldn't discount that at all.
But no African American has ever received more than 41% of the votes in a statewide race in Louisiana. Chris Thayer writes, I find it interesting, I think he's referring to me, that the folks who talk most about not seeing race are the ones who talk about candidates' qualification because of their race and promote race as a qualifying factor. He was referring to my remarks about Holden and Senator Guillory possibly being in a runoff for lieutenant governor. Well, that would be one way for an African American to win, though. If they both got in a runoff, it's a little hard to avoid a victory by one or the other. But Kip Holden, I think he knows because of what's happened in the past that he's going to have a real threshold to crack. He's got 9 percentage points to make up from what President Obama had in this state in either race for president.
Right, and it'll especially be interesting to see, too, if Elbert Guillory gets in the race. We actually have two very strong African-American candidates, one Republican and one Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Chris Tyson, a young man, he's African-American. He's a Democrat. He's really raising some real money for the Secretary of State's race next year. So I think we're seeing some good diversity on the ballot next year.
And it'll happen, I'm sure, in which a black person will win a statewide office. but it may be such that a black Republican wins a statewide office before a black Democrat.
You'd have to think that with the trends we're seeing now. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. This has been fun, and let's do it again more often. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Good to see you again. We're joined now by Stephen Maitland Lewis, who's been with us a few times, a noted author and a man who's a jazz aficionado. And I think your first appearance on our show a few years back, and it's been a few. Stephen, we talked about your past as a pen pal to Louis Armstrong. So with that as the backdrop, you're now living in the hometown of Satchmo. How are things in New Orleans?
Well, it's good to be back on your program. Thank you for having me again. New Orleans is very special to me and has been since I was practically 5 or 6 years old. Sadly, I'm only able to come for a few weeks every year, but it is a joy to be there. The minute I land at the airport, which of course is named Louis Armstrong International Airport, I get a huge kick, and it's always sad when my stay comes to an end.
And I think you have a unveiling of Botticelli's Bastard in New Orleans.
Indeed. The book was launched yesterday, and there's a launch party in California in Beverly Hills tomorrow evening. And, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I enjoyed writing the book. The hype of it is another factor in the dynamics. But it's a fun read. People who've read the book so far say it's a fun read and they enjoy it.
And Stephen is very good with his pen, as he was with Emeralds Never Fade and other works. And this one is, I think, ranks with his best works as a novelist. And you also spend a lot of time in Beverly Hills. Beverly Hills, the French Quarter.
You
like variety, don't you?
Absolutely. It's the spice of life, as the old cliche goes.
Well, I've been wondered. New Orleans, of course, has a terrible crime problem, and it unfortunately gets to the French Quarter. There isn't a whole lot of action in Beverly Hills. What do police officers and people like that do fighting crime every day in Beverly Hills?
Well, I touch wood and keep my fingers crossed, there is not serious crime within the area of Beverly Hills, which is a small area. There are seasonal break-ins, which always take place around Thanksgiving and Christmas time. But by and large, the crime rate within this little enclave of Los Angeles County is, thank goodness, limited.
But I bet the officers there make good money, don't they?
Oh, this is a constant issue, but it's not the money that they earn. The pension structure of city employees is actually something that does need to be reviewed. People are retiring at the age of 40, 45 years old, and then getting other jobs, full-paying jobs, but they're on full pension. You know, it's very difficult. You can't renegotiate easily people who've been employed on a contract for many, many years and suddenly say, we've got to review this. It's a thorny problem, but I believe that the pension fund is $200 million underwater at the moment.
My goodness.
That's in Beverly Hills, a population of around 40,000 people.
When I grow up, I want to be a cop in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, I think so. Better there than in the other parts of Los Angeles.
Yeah, or New Orleans or Baton Rouge.
I can't speak for Baton Rouge.
Great pay, great benefits, lots of sunshine, and very little crime.
Exactly.
So that's the perfect combination. And early retirement.
That's it.
Okay, well, Stephen J. Schwartz, who's also a best-selling author, he says of your latest work, Botticelli's Bastard, if Edgar Allan Poe and Oscar Wilde collaborated on an uplifting novel, it would have been Botticelli's Bastard. Maitland Lewis beat them to the punch, a marvelous, soulful tale.
That was very nice of him, wasn't it?
Very nice. Tell us about Giovanni Fabrizi.
Okay, Giovanni Fabrizi is a... restorer of old master paintings. And he comes from a long line of family background, where they've all been in the restoring profession. And he is working on a painting, and he gets very attached to the painting. The painting actually takes over his life. And the book really is the relationship between Fabrizi, the restorer, and the painting. The painting tells Fabrizi, and I say tells him, we don't know whether Fabrizi is imagining this or whether the painting is really speaking about his life's history. And Fabrizi has other things going on in his life, an unhappy marriage, his wife is out on the toot. There's a lot going on. But the more I think about this myself, having written the book, it's not unlike an actor who's playing a role, a method actor. He immerses himself so much in the part that his mind can be affected. I remember when I wrote a novel, Hero on Three Continents, which was a fictional biography of a gentleman in England. It took me about 2 years to write this book, and by the time the book was finished, I didn't know whether I was him or he was me. One was so immersed in it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and that's what happens.
You get into your work.
That's right. That's right. Well, the painting has this dialogue with the restorer, which sounds crazy, but, you know, I'm not comparing myself with Oscar Wilde, not at all, but in the picture of Dorian Gray, his painting aged. Well, my canvas talks.
Botticelli's Bastard, from the master storyteller Stephen Maitland Lewis. In Botticelli's mind, he is facing a dilemma. He believes a portrait was stolen during the greatest art heist in history, the Nazi plunder of European artwork. How does this affect him?
How does this affect Giovanni Fabrizi, the restorer? Because he ends up, by some circuitous route, which I cover in the book, owning the painting. But then he conducts research, and he discovers that there is a sole surviving person who is a member of the family that actually owned the painting before it was plundered by the Nazis. So this lady, who lives in dire circumstances in New York and is very elderly, is the rightful owner. So Giovanni Fabrizi is now torn. He has a moral issue. Does he keep the painting and stay quiet about this survivor who he's located? Or does he actually transfer ownership of the painting to her? So it's as if he has the angel on one shoulder telling him that he should hand over the painting to this lady in New York, in Hell's Kitchen, and the painting is worth scores of millions of dollars, or should he say nothing, and that's the devil speaking on the other shoulder, and keep the painting? Well, his family, his young wife and son, and friends in the art business all think he's nuts, and that he should just sell the painting and keep the money. So he has this moral dilemma, this tussle, and it's driving him crazy. Finally, he makes his decision what he's going to do with it.
You have lived on several continents. You're an art and jazz aficionado and a man who spent his world in international finance for several years of your life. How do these experiences affect your writing, Stephen?
Well, on my last book, Ambition, which was about a financial fraud in the banking sector, I did draw on inside information that I had about that particular milieu. I have been involved in the art world for some time. I've been a collector myself, not of works of the eminence and value of Botticelli, I would add, but my former wife was an art dealer, an eminent art dealer in Europe, so I was exposed on the periphery and by osmosis to what was going on. It has helped a lot. It has helped a lot to know certain cities, but cities change. So, I'm not necessarily as up to date as I was. You know, I was born and raised in London, and I left it in 1980, and it's changed considerably mm-hmm. since then. New York has changed. New York's changed for the better since I left it.
Right.
New York has become very safe and clean. So cities change. So, you know, one has to bear that in mind when one's writing and the period in which one's writing.
Any thoughts on the passing of Robin Williams?
It's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy. I was devastated when I heard it yesterday afternoon. I mean, this is something so awful. And it's just it just shows that this is one other medical condition, depression, that we have to forcibly and aggressively challenge, just like Alzheimer's. I mean, why? Why should a person who is on top of the world, universally acclaimed, an Oscar winner, a person with no financial concerns, seemingly happily married, why, you know? It's just too terrible.
Stephen, it's always good to talk with you, and I hope we can talk again. I like your viewpoints on just about every subject we cover, including politics, by the way. Stephen Maitland Lewis is back with a vengeance, and his latest novel is Botticelli's Bastard. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
My honor. Thank you. And we shall return tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.